Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How willing are you to try new foods? And is it worth the risk of a bad taste in your mouth for the experience of consuming ant larvae or horse meat or duck hearts on toast, knowing you might like them? My guest today is fascinated by the intrepid approach of some American foodies who these days seem as drawn to novel and challenging ingredients in their meals as they are to old favorites. And as unorthodox as those choices seem, it could be that a growing selection of extreme foods will be on all of our tables in the future. Dana Goodyear is a staff writer for The New Yorker. Her new book is called Anything That Moves, Renegade Chefs, Fearless Eaters, and the Making of a New American Food Culture. She joins us from the studios of NPR West. Dana, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So this book is a reminder that while, of course, we all get wrapped up in what we are eating, we are also endlessly fascinated in what other people are willing to eat.
Well, it's true. A lot of the inspiration for this new food movement comes out of other cultures or, you know, elements of American culture that have kind of been forgotten. So there's an emphasis, actually, even though a lot of the eating that I describe in the book is taking place in very, very fine restaurants and with very expensive bills that get delivered at the end of the meal, the food is inspired by the traditional foods of poverty. So chefs and diners alike are looking to cultures that have historically been more resourceful than we've needed to be in this country and taking inspiration for alternative proteins and plants to eat.
And the idea is that as the population grows and the places we can create food, raise food, remain finite, we might, in fact, have to turn back in a serious way, not just an experimental way, to some of these traditional foods.
That is the deeper message of this movement. It's that the way we have been eating, which is really a 20th century American way of eating, the industrialized food and the focus on very few plant and animal species and a real very intensive approach to growing those animals and plants, that's not sustainable. It's not good for individuals, for personal health, and it's not good for the planet, and it's not sustainable. There's an irony, too, which is that, you know, one of the regions that we're looking to, the avant-garde is looking to, is Asia and China in particular, which has for a long time had a huge population, as we know, and hasn't had the same, traditionally didn't have the same options available for protein. So, you know, things like insects, there's a cuisine around insects in China, and that's been a familiar part of their diet for a long time. Well, just as the cutting edge of American diners are starting to tune into, oh, we could eat insects, the Chinese are really adopting our style of eating. And, you know, an example of that is that the Smithfield ham deal. So the largest Chinese investment in America ever is happening right now, and it's in a pork company.
And I suppose the idea is, you know, now that there's more wealth in China, more people can afford things like meat, which used to be a luxury. Do you imagine that that will come full circle, that at some point in the future, China will sort of look at itself in the same way that Americans are beginning to look at the way we've consumed food?
It could be. I mean, there is an environmental movement in China. But what I can say for sure is that Americans who are interested in food and they have tended to move toward a kind of environmental sort of conscious eating. That's part of the food lover's perspective now, thanks to people like Michael Pollan. Mm-hmm. And there's a sense that broadening what Americans are willing to eat is both an exciting adventure for the palate, but also really important and ethical. And maybe, you know, just a way of expressing our anxiety about the future, too.
What are we to do with the term foodie? There are people who embrace it and people who really resent it.
It's true. It's sort of, it's a funny little word. You know, it irritates people. And someone reminded me the other day that, you know, when the term came around in 1980, Gail Green, an American food writer, coined it, and she was actually writing about some sort of the fans of Chef in Paris, but it's kind of the term has that kind of fanboy quality mm-hmm. to it. I actually like it. I acknowledge what's annoying about it, but I like it because it's a word that is a word in English, whereas our other words for describing people who really like and prioritize food come out of different languages. So we have gourmet, which is French, and it suggests a bias toward European food, and it also suggests a class and probably even a gender and a race. You know, I sort of think of it as the fat white male from the East Coast, and you know, with a gold pocket watch. And a foodie is anybody. It's such a democratic word. It can be, you know, foodieism is a youth movement to a large extent. And there's sort of a one-size-fits-all quality to it, which I think is really appropriate. It also, the diminutive also suggests something about the infancy of the food movement in America. We haven't been deeply invested in our food in this country for hundreds and hundreds of years. We've had an attitude, you know, this is the 20th century attitude I was referring to, of kind of shoving food off to the side. Mm. The food production happens out of view. The food itself is maybe unrecognizable for the animal that it comes from when you get it in front of you on your plate. And there's sort of an abstraction. And also, we've had a real interest in convenience food in this country. And I think that the food movement is coming around on that. But it is a young movement. And it has certain juvenile aspects to it, too. So I think that cute little foodie kind of makes sense in that regard as well.
So that obscuring of the food's origins would make, I mean, it would make sense that a response to that would be an embrace of what is more wild about food, which includes eating all kinds of things that we didn't grow up with on the table.
Yeah, and also seeing, you know, accepting cuts of animals that aren't just the you know, steak is skeletal muscle. Mm-hmm. And Americans for a long time have been comfortable pretty much exclusively with skeletal muscle. And now there are a lot of chefs making this argument and making wonderful food out of organ meats and extremities, you know, like pig ears are a big thing now, and tails. And it sounds kind of uncomfortable sometimes to hear that, but that is a traditional way of eating. It's a traditional European way of eating. And it does also connect to that more resourceful eating. And in this country, those cuts have been going to the pet food industry for a long time. And now I've talked to friends in the pet food industry who say that it's way too expensive to serve those things now because all the American chefs want, you know, all the chefs want them for their restaurants. But there is a more of an emphasis on what you see is what you get now. Hmm. So that the connection, chefs are making the connection on the plate for people about what that this was an animal, what kind of an animal it was, and what did it eat. And we're seeing that in the presentation now.
Did you come to any perspective on why many of us are delighted to tuck into a nice beefsteak, but the thought of anyone being served horse meat is absolutely abominable?
That's a really interesting one. A lot of the taboos that I look at in the book I found have something in common, and this is true for insects, it's true for horse, and it's even true for whale, which is that they are associated with poverty and desperation. Hmm. Horse is something that has been eaten in this country, but only as a last resort. And we have a national self-conception which says that we are so prosperous, and we've been living with this myth for a long time that we don't need to resort to those things. And so it's disgusting to resort to those things. It's sort of a repression of a reality. And to me, it's fascinating that that is now returning in a gourmet context, that people are saying, well, this is totally legitimate meat. And we can put an asterisk there and talk about that in a second, but that it's wasteful. You know, there's just a vast amount of available meat that we're getting rid of for no good reason. What are you going to do? You know, build graveyards for all these horses? There are some health questions that I think are legitimate that are associated with, you know, whether we should be eating horses that are not raised as food animals. Mm-hmm. But in general, it's a poverty, it's an anxiety about poverty that has made that a taboo in America. But in the 70s, when their beef prices rose, there were horse meat butcher shops that opened up and down the East Coast. So it's not that far out of reality for us.
You attended a really interesting dinner party hosted by, of all people, the former L.A. County Health Inspector.
What? Not
A
numero uno. Yeah, but
yes. Can you tell us what was on the table, on the menu there?
This dinner was interesting for so many reasons, but one of them was that it was required. You know, we signed up for it. It was a special event, one time only. You know, this is a kind of thing that's really common in dining now, these sort of pop-up menus and pop-up restaurants. And it was, for one night, they were going to be serving a menu where you were meant to have no psychological or physical or medical restrictions on what you could eat. Now, I thought this alone was fascinating, that that's what is being asked of diners now. And this was a bit of an extreme case, but something like that is being asked of diners all the time now. Come to this completely open, completely willing. It's not you go to a restaurant to choose your favorite thing and eat that. It's you go to a restaurant as a blank slate, as a guinea pig almost for the chef to experiment on. And everything at this meal was meant to provoke in some way and meant to overturn people's biases about what is edible. So there was live octopus. And I should say it also drew from many different cultures, but all of them have in common that sort of resourceful eating. So there was huitlacoche, which is a fungus that grows on corn and is a delicacy in Mexico and is increasingly prized here. It's worth a lot of money. It's $31 a pound. You know, the farmers who used to throw out their corn in fury because it was had this corn smut on it, then some of them wised up and realized it was worth a lot more with the fungus. And there was live octopus, and there was lamb heart, and there were three different kinds of brains served, and everything was meant to be delicious, and through that convince you that something that you might have pushed away in horror is actually delectable.
So when you sit down for something like that, where you know you will be presented with things that culturally at least you've sort of been raised to stay away from. I mean, do you feel in some ways like a 3-year-old, you know, forced to sit at the grown-ups table? What's the experience like to really, and it sounds like you're a pretty open-minded eater, but how do you let go of your prejudices, if you want to call them that?
Well, I think that you just, you have to trust. And all eating is an act of trust, right? That's built into our evolutionary history and our DNA, is that we're omnivores and we try a lot of different things and we don't always hit the jackpot with taste or with even digestibility. So I think, you know, built into our human condition is a fascination with new foods and also a caution about new foods. And so for me, doing this reporting, there was always a balance there I do begin as an open-minded person. I actually discovered my limits in the course of the reporting. And there was another layer to it, which is that at a certain point in the reporting, I became pregnant. Right. So I had this other consideration, and it made me more sensitive to the feelings of my readers who might have started off being less open. So I think it was actually, first I was a little worried about how it would affect the reporting, but then it actually was good, and it helped me discover my limits and also my ability to decline food, which I'd never really done before.
My guest is Dana Goodyear. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker and author of the new book, Anything That Moves, Renegade Chefs, Fearless Eaters, and the Making of a New American Food Culture. If you'd like to join the conversation, maybe share the most unusual thing you've ever eaten and liked or disliked. We'd love to hear from you. We have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can send email to think@kera.org or tweet me at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with New Yorker staff writer Dana Goodyear, the author of the new book Anything That Moves, Renegade Chefs, Fearless Eaters, and the Making of a New American Food Culture. Join the conversation by emailing think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. Dana, Jonathan Gold is such a fascinating character. Will you tell us about him and about the influence that he has had?
So Jonathan Gold is a restaurant critic here in Los Angeles. 25 years ago, he started documenting the foods being served in these small ethnic restaurants all around the city, restaurants that a lot of Angelenos never set foot in. These restaurants reflect LA's status as a place of first entry, port of first entry for a lot of immigrants in this country. And they preserve the culture almost intact of the immigrants' homes. So there is an argument that Jonathan Gold makes that, you know, you can eat the foods of the world without ever leaving Los Angeles. Mm. And he made this kind of eating, which often involves being exposed to totally unfamiliar foods and styles of preparation and textures, he made that really available to a lot of people who otherwise would never have dared. And he's sort of the Pied Piper of foodies. He spoke in a language, he's a music lover and a musician and a music critic first, actually. And he was able to speak the language of young readers. And so he kind of shaped the demographics, I think, of the foodie movement to a large extent. And he won a Pulitzer Prize for this work. He's still the only food critic who's ever won a Pulitzer. So his influence is well established by that. But he also set the pace for a lot of, you know, for people like Andrew Zimmern and Anthony Bourdain, who have larger reach in a sense because they've got a platform on television. But Jonathan has been doing this kind of thing for 25 years, and I think he's pretty remarkable. He's really fantastic lunch partner, too. He knows everything.
And he's said that he's gone to some places and been told, you really don't want that, and he's insisted that he wants something and then realized he doesn't want it, and then he's got to eat it.
Exactly. Yeah. So he epitomizes that kind of, you know, muscle your way through it and the mind over matter aspect of that. But he also really enjoys eating deeper in the animal and lower on the food chain. And he's made that sound delicious and cool and fun. And he's made that sound like an adventure to a lot of his readers.
How does he make his discoveries? I was astonished at how much he drives in a given year.
He drives about 30,000 miles a year just around LA County. And he basically looks at signs he's learned over time to recognize. He doesn't speak other languages or read other languages, and he's learned to recognize the look of a certain restaurant. If the curtains are tattered in just the right way, if the music is, you know, cheesy and local in just the right way, and if, you know, there's Korean golf on the big screen TV and he sees people eating in there, eating interesting things at another table, he'll go in, he'll point. He uses Google Translate a little bit. He uses tips from people who do speak these languages, but he's very willing to go and be the lone white guy in a restaurant where people might be really discouraging him because out of a fear that their food will be rejected. That's really what it comes from. But he's really comfortable going in there and finding a way to get served good food.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Julie calling from Saxe. Hi, Julie.
Hello?
Hi, Julie. Go right ahead.
Okay. It seems like it's a badge of courage if you can eat spicy food nowadays, and everywhere I go, it's so spicy. Actually, I can't find anything to eat, and I'm hoping this is a trend. Could you tell me whether you think it is or not?
Well, it's a great point. I do think that the turning up the heat has a connection to the more competitive macho side of the food movement that I look at. And I do think there is hope for you. I do think that that type of showing off is going to eventually that'll run its course. I think that's speaks to the newness of this food movement and the youth of it, that it's kind of, you know, a I dare double dare you type of thing. And I think that a lot of chefs feel that the way to explore flavors is actually by revealing them, and that sometimes spices, if not used with great delicacy, they can overwhelm flavors. So I do think that that's probably a limited phenomenon.
What do you make of this idea that, that there are certain foods that you sort of prove your manhood by being willing to eat?
Well, I see. I know it's off-putting to a lot of people. People talk about the bro culture of foodieism, and meaning just, you know, this macho thing, this manly thing. It's there. It's unmistakably there. But I look at it as a way of opening up an interest in food to part of the population that might have thought that it was not acceptable for them to be into food. So to me, it seems, of course, it has some surface features which can be a little bit annoying. But in general, I think it's a good thing. And I think that we're going to find ourselves in a few years in a place where just with so many more people caring about what they eat and where it came from and what the story is behind it, the food is just going to be a lot better.
I loved your chapter on the sort of evolution of what is now extreme foodieism in America, starting with the importation of delicacies from around the world after the Second World War.
Yeah, the specialty food business started with refugees from Europe who came here because of World War II. And a lot of them had other businesses in Europe and came here and realized, you know, they had to start over. They knew about some food from back home, and they thought that, you know, Americans might like to diversify their kind of meat and potatoes diet. And they started bringing in caviar and foie gras and barbecued baby bees, and they started putting rattlesnake in tins, and tiger meat and elephant meat from zoos. And so the range of things, some of them are now accepted as gourmet food. You know, this became the gourmet food business. But right alongside the foie gras from very early on was, you know, the tinned tiger meat, something that we would now think of as totally unacceptable and bizarre. And at the same time, Hawaiian punch was also presented as a specialty food back then. So our sense of what is exotic, what is special, what is fancy, it all really changes over time. And we forget that. We now think of, you know, balsamic vinegar as a given, but there was a time when it was an exotic. And at the Fancy Food Show now, which happens twice a year and is kind of the relic of this mid-century time, this post-war period, you can still see Walker shortbread. You know, it's a very familiar thing. It's in every grocery store, Walker shortbread. But they still have a booth at the specialty food store because it was in the 70s that a couple of guys from the Bronx went to Europe and brought back the Walkers. And it was a really small market, and only now is it so massive. But yeah, these things change a lot. And there was always this element of provocation, always this element of broadening. And it's fascinating to see how we still have that now.
And it's also interesting to think about foods that seem exotic and that we might initially be inclined to sort of reject as a society. You know, there's, of course, the case of sushi. And I want to be careful about how I call this exotic, because people have been eating it, you know, in Japan for thousands of years. But, you know, a lot of Americans hadn't really even heard of it before, I guess, the mid-70s. And now, I mean, a lot of people I know take their kids out for sushi and nobody blinks an eye.
Yeah, my mom lives in St. Louis, the middle of the country, nowhere near the ocean, and, you know, all the grocery stores have sushi. So right, this is a totally mainstream American convenience food now. And it, when we say exotic, you're exactly right. I mean, you have to be specific about what you mean, but exotic to Americans. And what happened with sushi is a great potential, you know, it shows a pathway for something like insects, which a lot of Americans still think of as pretty impossible to imagine eating. Sushi was introduced in the 60s in Los Angeles, and it was really an exotic food here for a long time. And then it was three factors. The person who brought the first sushi bar to America told me it was three factors, only one of them having anything to do with food, that made it go mainstream. It was the rise of the Japanese car, the rearrangement of the government food pyramid to emphasize fish, and the best-selling novel Shogun. Wow. By James Clavell. So there were these external cultural factors that changed the way people viewed anything Japanese, and it got people excited about it. So what are those factors going to be for crickets? Mm-hmm. Maybe we'll find out in a couple of years. I have a couple of theories about it, but none of it is proven yet.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Manfred in Dallas. Hi, Manfred.
Hi, Chris. This is such an interesting topic. I grew up in the Philippines, and I have seen a lot of really and eaten a lot of unique food over there. I've eaten beetles that come out in June, and depending on the region, I have not eaten, but I've seen on the northern part of the Philippines, every time the termite swarms come out, children would catch them with their nets, and they cook it over fire. And of course, the chicken as a whole, nothing is wasted, from the feet to the tip of the beak, except for the feathers. We eat all of them, even the blood of the chicken and the pigs. This is very economical for countries like developing countries. There's nothing wasted, and I hope the Western nations learn from this, and they can be quite good. I still make a dish out of pig's blood here in the U.S. I still make them every now and then, and it's enjoyed in every potluck that we have.
So, Manfred, if you tell your neighbors who are not from the Philippines, do you tell them what it is, or do you let them taste it first, fall in love with it, and then reveal the contents?
Yeah, in fact, this dish with pig's blood, my brother-in-law loves him. He's American, and he just loves him. And but you know the factor, and we're kind of ashamed to tell, but the other people what it is made of, you know, because they will, once they get to know, they might not respond in a very satisfactory way. But they do taste good, and those who doesn't know or who have tasted them just say, oh, they taste very well.
What a fascinating call. Thank you so much for that, Manfred. And Dana, I know that you had some interesting, particularly interesting experiences with Filipino delicacies.
Oh, yeah. And I just thank you for that call. I wanted to say that one of the more interesting things that I learned in the course of reporting, a guy who studies bugs said to me, you know, mark my words, if in Europe we had insects the size of pigs, all Westerners would be eating insects. Hmm. It's simply about what was available. And we don't have a cuisine around insects in this country because we had other options and our forebears had other options. And I think it's so interesting to talk to people who come out of cultures where those options weren't there necessarily. And so these beautiful cuisines and recipes emerge that make those things delicious. Those things aren't inherently disgusting. We don't have a connection to them as food, so we think of them that way. But yeah, Filipino food is extremely fascinating and resourceful. And one of the things I ate that was a little bit tricky for me as a Westerner, because just the psychological barrier, it tasted very familiar, just like chicken soup and hard-boiled eggs, but it was the balut, the unhatched duckling that's cooked in its shell and eaten whole. And that was hard for me, I have to say, but I muscled through.
Why did you feel like you had to try it?
It's a good question. It was sort of the it was the recurring motif among food people that I talked to over the course of years of reporting. It was always kind of a, well, have you had balut? And it kept coming up, and I just thought, if I'm really going to be a guide to my readers in this world, I should know what this tastes like. And I'm looking, you know, part of the book is a bit of a quest of my own and sort of looking to explore what my limitations are. And I thought this would be a perfect test of my limitations.
Well, let's talk about things like insects that are eaten in many parts of the world, and not only by people who are sort of, you know, subsisting, but they are prepared, deliciously and used in a variety of different dishes. What are some of the ways that you think things like crickets and grubs might find their way into our diets at some point?
Well, I think it's already here and in Mexican cooking. You know, the chapulines, those little teeny grasshoppers, and those are served crispy with lime and fresh cheese, and they are delicious sort of bar food, snacks type of thing. And you can already get that in a number. I'm not going to say most Mexican restaurants in America, but certainly there are a couple places to get them in Los Angeles. I know of chefs who are putting them on the menus in places like Las Vegas. And that, I think, because Americans really accept and connect to Mexican food, mm-hmm. I think that that might be a place that we would be more comfortable meeting an insect. But there's a whole other thing happening with the insects where people, Western entrepreneurs, are saying, okay, we need to sidestep the problem of the psychological barrier that exists for a lot of Americans about eating bugs. So let's grind them up, make them make flour, and then put it in a protein bar, that kind of thing. And there are a number of those products hitting the market now.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Rob on the line in Arlington. Hi, Rob.
Hey, yeah. I love your show. And I was at A&M and had a degree in wildlife fisheries science. And we had a barbecue every year, and the animals were done scientific. If you didn't know the scientific name of the animal, you wouldn't know what you were eating. And one of the animals that I had tasted was bobcat. And I actually found it quite tasty. It was very good. There was also the javelina and rattlesnake and stuff. But it was interesting stuff to taste. And I just wanted to mention that.
Well, Rob, thank you so much for your call. We'll get a response from Dana, but we're going to take a quick break first here. Dana Goodyear is my guest. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker and the author of a book called Anything That Moves, Renegade Chefs, Fearless Eaters, and the Making of a New American Food Culture. If you'd like to share a story of something you have tried, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. You can also send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Dana Goodyear, a staff writer for The New Yorker, who is the author of the new book Anything That Moves, Renegade Chefs, Fearless Eaters, and the Making of a New American Food Culture. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. And Dana, before the break, we had the call and we heard about a wildlife barbecue that folks at Texas A&M had for a while. And he had tried a number of sort of things that we would consider unusual to eat that he liked very much.
Well, what I was really interested in about that story was that he said that the meats were presented labeled only with their scientific names.
Right.
So that it brings up a great point, which is that some of our resistance to new foods has to do with nomenclature and our association with various things. So a lot of the people I talked to said, you know, if we want people to eat insects, we can't call them mealworms. That doesn't sound good to us. We have to think, you know, the Latin name is Tenebrio molitor. Maybe you call it a Tenebrio quiche and it sounds kind of fancy and gourmet. And there are other examples of that with horse meat. When there was an earlier movement in the 19th century to get English people, it was eaten in France, and the English were trying to deal with the problem of meat shortages. And there was a movement of the English Society for the Propagation of Horse Flesh, which a very awkward sounding little social club. But they would have these big banquets and they'd hire French chefs to serve chevaline. And chevaline is horse meat, but it's more acceptable somehow to have this word in French. So I think it is often our resistance is right out in front at the level of the name of the thing we're being asked to eat.
On the other hand, you write about delicacies like shark fin soup, which is very controversial these days because it often the fins are harvested, often the rest of the shark, including all that meat that could be eaten, is dumped back in the ocean. It's decimating populations. There is like a pretty good substitute available, but people want it specifically because it is rare.
There is that tension in the food world. So not everybody comes at it from the same perspective. And the people that are the most interesting and I hope are going to be the most influential are those who are making an argument for eating unfamiliar things that are sustainable, that are lower on the food chain, and that have been overlooked because they've been not needed to this point or despised because of their association with poverty, and to have those things be recast as food that is appropriate for everyone, but you know, starting with the fanciest eaters, I think that that's a good direction for things to move. There, it has its own ironies, but it's a good direction for things to move in terms of enjoying things that are rare and are rare because they are totally unsustainable. You know, that's a bummer. I think that the finning of the sharks is cruel, and you know, they often drown. They don't want to carry the bodies back because the market value for the bodies is so much less than for the fin itself. So they cut off the fin and the sharks bleed out and drown. And it's horrifying to imagine that, really.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Amir in Plano. Hi, Amir.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to make a comment that you had earlier said that we are opening up about Americans are more welcoming with eating more organs. So our family comes from Indian subcontinent. So we're from Pakistan. We've always eaten like goat liver, goat kidney, even the brain and intestines, and we've never liked the brain and intestine part. But there's like a really popular delicacy which is combined of like goat or lamb, a liver, heart, kidney, and then even testicles that people enjoy in Pakistan and parts of India that I don't know if the author is familiar with, but it's the goat organs are really, or lamb or sheep organs are really welcoming in our culture. So that's all I had to say.
Thanks for your call. Dana?
Yeah, that's really, really interesting. I think that even the idea of eating goat is sort of new to a lot of Americans, but the exploration of the different organs, I think what's happening in some restaurants in this country is offal, you know, the innards are being presented, tends to be more from the more quote-unquote, you know, American animals, the ones that we're more familiar with, like cows, basically cows and pigs. But I think that goat meat is becoming sort of a thing here, and that comes out of the Latin tradition mm-hmm. for the most part. But maybe goat organ meats are not far behind. I don't know. It's fascinating to hear about that. Thank you.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have David on the line in McKinney. Hey, David.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Great. Thank you for taking my call. I was interested in the show, and it seemed very interesting. I just had a quick question or comment, and I was wondering if your guests would comment on it, particularly when you're talking about eating insects. It doesn't necessarily concern me about eating an insect, but the food web is so complicated with organisms like that. I'd be curious about the parasitic organisms within the insect waiting for it to be consumed so it can get a new host.
Interesting
question.
It's
a really great question. Insects are not immune from these problems. So, you know, salmonella is actually a problem in insects. The deal with insects in America is that we don't really have a production system for them. So there are no standards. They are unregulated. They're not considered by the FDA or the USDA. So it is a bit of a risk now to eat those things. But all food, as we know, has risk associated with it. And you can't eliminate the risk in the industrial system either. You know, the regulations that we set up in the beginning of the last century in about 1906 intended to ensure the purity of food. And what's happened is that an industrial food system has been locked into place that has its own problems built in. So there are outbreaks of listeria and salmonella and, you know, that wretched new form of E. coli that is so devastating to young people and the elderly. And there is no such thing as completely safe food. But with insects, you do have to be careful for a number of reasons. What you just mentioned, the parasites and the bacteria that I mentioned. And then also, you know, people, you know, wild harvesting, well, you don't know if those insects were burrowing around in pesticide-laden soil. So you really do need to be careful with that.
Okay, I have sort of left a very little time left in our interview. We've got about 8 minutes, but I want to talk about the raw milk and raw dairy movement, because this is something you explore at length in the book, and it really is a sort of fascinating, I would still call it a subculture in this country, but it's a really interesting one. Can you tell us a little bit about what you learned?
The raw milkers are some of the most impassioned food activists that I have encountered. They are really convinced that the milk that they drink, that the health benefits associated with raw milk are essential. You know, in a lot of cases, these people have medical problems, or they just also love the flavor of it. There's a good number of very, very high-end chefs who have told me, you know, extolled the virtues of raw milk and that it's so much more flexible as an ingredient, and it also connects us to our pre-industrial agricultural heritage in this country. But the activist population is more concerned about the health benefits, I would say. So the laws about raw milk in this country there's a patchwork of laws, and basically, you know, there's several states where you are allowed to sell raw milk. It's very heavily regulated, and there are a number of states where it can only be sold as pet food, and there are a number of states where it's illegal, but nowhere is it illegal to cross state lines with raw milk. So there is an underground network, because this makes it really hard for people to get raw milk, and, you know, the Amish in Pennsylvania are making a lot of it, and most of the time it's crossing state lines, and people are getting arrested, people are going to jail, and it is a real political crisis and probably one of the hottest topics for food activists right now.
Now, you know, for people who are going, what a nanny state, I can't believe people can't have what they want, there were some pretty solid reasons for requiring pasteurization. You may or may not agree with them, but there was a foundation for those laws.
Absolutely. The government considers providing, you know, clean milk, and I'm going to kind of put air quotes around that word clean milk, because that's a matter of debate. But pasteurized milk is one of its fundamental responsibilities, and akin to providing clean water. And a lot of government folks that I spoke to said, can you imagine this conversation happening about water? Could you imagine people arguing to be able to drink contaminated water, which is how they view the raw milk movement and their desire to have milk that hasn't been pasteurized? And the you know, mass pasteurization started there was a big problem in this country in the 19th century with dairies that were attached to whiskey distilleries, and the cows were fed the spent grains from the distillation process, and it boosted milk production in the short term, but it made the cows really sick. This was a very unhealthy diet, and the milk was full of organisms, and a lot there was no cold chain also, so the milk was going into the cities, and it was not being kept at correct temperatures, and a lot of kids got sick and died. And so this is the public health crisis that pasteurization was brought in to solve. So government feels like, why would you want to unsolve this? We had a beautiful solution. It worked great. What's the problem? So they're really at odds. They see it very, very differently.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Nancy on the line in Denton. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I thought of some more things since I was on hold.
Oh, all right. You've eaten a lot of exciting things. Is that right?
Yeah. With my Swedish aunt, because I wanted to throw that in, because we tend to think of third world countries as eating these things, and she grew up in Europe and South America, and you name it, and they eat them. Many Europeans eat them too. I recently ate worms. I have it on TTSL, and we were doing a story on in Scholastic Scope magazine was about bugs and how a third of the population eats bugs. And, of course, the kids were freaked out at first, and then at the end of the lesson, I ate the bug and had another kid eat one that his parents said he could. But I've eaten jellyfish, mantis stingray, barracuda, baby shark, turtle. Most of that was in Cozumel. I lived there for a while. I've eaten rabbit, frog legs, delicious. My Aunt Gunilla has eaten chocolate-covered grasshoppers and ants. I've eaten many organs. I'm not really big on organs. Obviously, I'm not a vegetarian.
So, Nancy, but, what makes you so open to this, and maybe your next-door neighbor wouldn't dream of eating these things?
Oh, squirrel. Because as I grew up, we were kind of like the Clampets, the Beverly Hillbillies. Not exactly, but my father and brother would hunt. I mean, we lived in a nice suburban home, but we didn't have lots and lots of money, so they would hunt, and they would get rabbit and squirrel and that kind of thing, and dove, you know, birds, so we would eat that. So I just kind of grew up with that, and then my aunt Gunilla from Sweden was very influential in my life as well from the time I was born.
Well, let me jump in, Nancy, because I want to have, I want Dana to have a chance to respond. Your dad was a hunter as well, Dana.
Yeah, that's right. So I think that, I don't know, in my experience, when you grow up getting some meat from that source, you don't think of it as threatening. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea that you could get food, most of our food did come from the grocery store, but I always had in my mind the idea that you could get food from other places too, and that the array, you know, they weren't selling venison at the grocery store in Cleveland, Ohio, where I was a kid, but we were getting it because my dad would bring it home from hunting trips.
There is, like, I guess, a really gratifying sense of self-sufficiency in the idea that if somehow, you know, every grocery store around closes down, you know how to forage for food, you know how to hunt for food. That's something that a lot of Americans have no connection to.
That's right. And that's why it's so interesting to me that this disaster mentality, this emergency preparedness mentality is visible on plates in restaurants where it costs $250 a head. Mm. So I see this, the foraging movement, the alternative meats and proteins, all of these things, and the organ meats is part of the same thing. Our finest restaurants are presenting menus that might come out of a survivalist handbook.
Do you have any plan as a parent to raise your child with a particular openness to new foods?
I have two kids.
Two kids, okay.
I think the way that I answer their questions is already influenced by the thinking that I've been doing lately about this book. I mean, I grew up pretty open because my parents are pretty open, but I also learned a lot about the origins of our, you know, reasons for rejecting certain foods in this country. And I'm hoping to raise kids that are citizens of the world in that way. And whether they travel abroad or not, that they're open to foods that come from other cuisines.
Something tells me you will succeed in that. Dana Goodyear is a staff writer for The New Yorker with a new book out called Anything That Moves, Renegade Chefs, Fearless Eaters, and the Making of a New American Food Culture. She joined us today from the studios of NPR West. Dana, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had help today producing the show from Christina Martinez. Christine McConnell prepares our podcast. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.